We've long since gone past the ideas about animal or plant kingdom. Leaving out the G, making it kingdom, is a much better reference point. With this in mind, join me with Predrag Slijepcevic, evolution scientist, to hear him discussing his book, Biocivilizations, A New Look at the Science of Life, where the lead role is played by bacteria, or perhaps more broadly, microbes. I'm Robin, and this is Tributaries. I love that you wrote, "The wisdom of our age is flimsy." And I want to get the human self-importance out of the way. And your quote from your book, Biocivilizations, should do it. Humans are non-essential byproducts of what mostly amount to microbial evolutionary games. Do you get a lot of argument with that?
Well, I think it depends on the audience. I guess the scientific audience, there are some people who share my views that I think it's well established that the microbes precede us for a long, long time. But I guess this thought is less familiar to the general audience who are getting this idea that perhaps we are really latecomers, we humans are latecomers in the evolution. And, you know, when you look at that statistically, I mean, most people understand numbers. So 99.99% of the evolutionary time has been without us. So we are really tiny, tiny percentage of that huge, what I like to call matrix, the matrix of the biosphere, that has its temporal and spatial dimensions. So, you know, we are temporally, you know, very, very tiny part of that. Problem starts when we put ourselves first in that matrix and argue from a completely wrong footing.
Yeah, certainly. And so not only is it throughout time how minimal the humans are, but also as far as how much space we take up on the planet as well, because aren't plants and bacteria like an insane percentage, 90%?
Yeah, when you look at the biosphere as a whole, the entire population of animals that exist on Earth at present is much, much less than 1%. So plants and bacteria dominate. But there is one thing where we really dominate the human culture, the human civilizations, all those products of technology, you know, the buildings, the factories, everything we produce is really huge. That exceeds the biosphere many, many times. But that's the nature of life. If you take bacteria, for example, we know that bacteria produce what I called in the book cities. The technical name in science for that is bacterial biofilms. So when you look at those bacterial biofilms, the bacterial cities essentially, and you estimate the biomass, 99% of the biomass are building material they produce,
right?
Like our building, etc. But the difference between us and bacteria, for example, is that bacteria produce the building material themselves. They secrete that from their bodies, whereas we collect that from nature. And perhaps that's the reason why bacterial cities are more sustainable. They produce sugars, DNA, lipids, and use that to construct their cities, whereas we have to destroy the environment.
Right.
You know, to create a city the size of New York, I think you have to destroy one quarter of the, you know, environment in the United States or something like that. So our engineering skills or building skills create what you may call instability in the biosphere, whereas bacteria, they don't do that. Or the other organisms, when they produce their own buildings, these are much more sustainable. They are constrained by this matrix that I call the biosphere.
Yes, and just hearing you say that it's constrained, or is it intelligence?
You may call it intelligence, yes. I mean, the great thinker that I often quoted in my book, Gregory Bateson, he was one of the founders of the cybernetics. He called that intelligence, but before the term intelligence, he used the term epistemology. So knowledge creation is an essential part of living,
yes,
of the biosphere. So the knowledge creation or cognition, basically, that's a biological universal. So all the species, bacteria, plants, animals, they have their own cognitive worlds that I call biocivilization. And that, in a sense, is a kind of natural intelligence that's more in tune,
right,
with this matrix. Whereas our intelligence, it's great, no doubt about it, we are intelligent, but basically is not in tune with the rest of the biosphere. So if we want to survive as a civilization, we're almost forced to continue with this destructive path.
You know, I've always loved that shamanic outlook. The shamanic viewpoint looks at the plants sort of molding us, leading the way for us. And it certainly doesn't hurt to think like that, does it? I think it can only bring more intelligent inquisitions.
Yes, I think this is something that helps us see our epistemological errors. I think all native cultures had their own kind of views about nature, and these were often much more in tune with the natural matrix. They saw plants as beings like us.
Yeah.
Our own modern culture assesses the natives and their wisdom is often very arrogant.
Absolutely.
I mean, a typical example, I found that in a book, the situation was very clear. It was about the way people living in the north of Europe, natives, the Lapland, that's north of Finland, they had their own understanding of those long polar nights, and they taught that basically during those long polar nights, there are some sounds produced, and this was built in their culture. So they taught there is also sound to that light. Scientists actually disputed that. They said, no, that's a superstition. You know, and they completely dismissed that. But what happened about 10 years ago, a Finnish acoustic engineer really did a very detailed study and has proven that those long polar nights, they do produce sound. So basically, people from the native culture of the Lapland was right.
Yes.
So, but the scientists still don't want to correct themselves. Yeah, it's sad in a way, but that's the reality.
Right. And it's always sort of struck me as odd that, I mean, this is totally generic in saying that scientists feel like they're on the cutting edge and they're finding out this information, and they do. But then when they can't accept the next new thing or even look at it, that's the piece that is very odd to me. And certainly the sciences of vibration, light, and sound are coming into vogue now because there are instruments to measure it. I believe I've heard you talk about how you would like to see science moving into, or maybe perhaps it has to move into, more of a consciousness. And these instruments are helping us get there.
Yes, I think my own views about science, I must not be too impolite to towards my colleagues. I think science is something to stay, and we have to accept it, but at the same time, we have to accept the limits.
Yeah.
For me, proper science, the real science, science that really discovers something new that we didn't know before, is actually more like art rather than science.
And that's your philosophical background. You studied philosophy as well.
That's true. But I think the idea of science existing as a form of art is not new. it comes from both philosophy, but also comes from the scientific practice. One of the great physicists and mathematicians of the 20th century, David Bohm, he was a kind of heretic scientist, but a genius. So he taught that the world as a system is actually aesthetic, is not mechanical.
Yes, I like that for sure. Couldn't agree more. Look at Da Vinci, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the standard view of mainstream science is that the physics is on top, then chemistry, and then biology, and the world as a system is mechanical system. And we treat the world, everything outside us, outside our own culture, as mechanical. And we want to understand the mechanics of that world, but you know, you see that that world really is not mechanical. It's constantly changing, so it's more like a work of art.
Yes, to be alive is to be an artist. And just stay with wonder, and just seems to me like it's an endless platform. We can just go anywhere with it. And what you were just talking about brought up a point that I wanted to ask you about, writing about Roger Penrose suggesting physicists drop the compartmental burden of their scientific shoulders and go beyond theories such as quantum mechanics. Could you talk about what you mean by that and speak to the layman here, not the scientist?
Yes. In a sense, Penrose was saying the same as this guy I just mentioned, David Bohm. So Penrose is coming more from the mechanicist scientific culture. He's a professor of mathematics at Oxford, and he follows this traditional scientific path. And he's really a great mathematician, and he sees something wrong with that approach, treating the world as a mechanical system. So he always says, Penrose, life is more than computation, because science treats life, we are like computers, you know, cells are computers, our bodies are machines full of small computers or cells. Right. But it's not like that. We are not machines. We much more than that. And you, I think, capture that very nicely. I mean, there are trillions of possibilities that are at our disposal, and we're only using a tiny, tiny fraction of that. But that's the nature of life. Life is about this enormous compendium of possibilities that will always be available to all living beings. Yes. And our culture, what happened with our culture is that it almost deliberately narrowed down that range of possibilities to a very, very tiny fraction. And perhaps that's wrong. Because once we get out of that very narrow tunnel, then we see a larger picture. You know, it's not easy for science to get out of that really narrow tunnel, but eventually we have to get out of that.
Right. It's funny, a lot of your work and research has taken you down into the smallest bacterias and microbes, and yet look at the world it's opened up for you. I mean, you just mentioned the computer. You must cringe every time you hear someone say, oh, well, the mind is like this, and they mention something about the computer, and yet the computer is just barely a piece of what we've got as a full-bodied life and part of the natural system. I learned a new word reading your book, which was eusociality, and that being the highest level of social organization in the animal kingdom. Do you think bacteria have it down? Have you been able, through all of your research, to be able to see them growing their civilization and how they do things? Or is it just such a monumental timeline that you haven't really been able to see a shift?
This term eusociality, this applies exclusively to animals. So I think a great American naturalist, Edward O. Wilson, he was a proponent of that, and he got into kind of a clash with Richard Dawkins about the genes and the social organization, and really we can't apply the same social norms on bacteria as we can on animals, because animals, first of all, these are multi-cell organisms, whereas bacteria are single-cell organisms.
Yes.
Bacteria, they're from the outset, from the beginning of life. So the bacteria join our bodies, and all animal bodies, these are called microbiomes.
Yes.
So if you wish, the bacteria are like the ground on which the entire life has been built. So even you social organisms like us or ants or honeybees, they can't live without bacteria.
Right.
They can't exist without bacteria. So bacteria are there like something that we don't see, but it's essential. We can't survive without it. There is a term in physics, I mean, this is more kind of technical, it's called the phase space. The biological phase space is, I guess, microbes. What makes the matrix are bacteria and these tiny right. creatures. And then from those relationship, we grow as multicell organisms, and we can't really survive without having our bacterial friends.
Yes.
Inside and outside our bodies.
Yes. And I loved that in, I think it was part two of your book, there were chapters that were scientists, doctor, artists, farmers. Tell us about the relationship you're making there.
Yeah. I think what I wanted to say was that when you say civilization to an ordinary person, even a person who didn't go to the university, they immediately link that with the human culture. But what I wanted to do was to basically try to promote the idea that this kind of civilization as the highest intellectual skill of humans is not actually the human at all. Every single species has those skills. And the way for me to go into kind of deeper levels was to say, okay, if we have engineering skills and this is what makes our civilization what it is today, what about the engineering skills of bacteria or plants? And when you look at that, you see basically that plant engineering skills are much, much more sophisticated than ours.
Yes.
Whereas our engineering skills are, I mean, the modern engineering skills like buildings, computers, things like that, this is something based on modern science, 300-400 years old. Whereas the plant engineering skills, this is a spectrum of 400 million years. So when I say engineering skills of plants, I mean the forests. So the forests basically occupy 1/3 of the planetary landmass. And when you go into any big forest, you basically enter a very, very ancient civilization that contains thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of species. And they all live in kind of protected environment, shielded by what plants or trees produce through symbiosis with fungi that live underground. And the underground network of fungi and roots of trees produce really extensive communication channels
yes.
that enable, essentially present itself as a really multicultural civilization that allows bacteria, plants, animals, protists, amoebas live in harmony.
What you were just talking about really made me feel why it feels so good to walk in a forest or spend time out in nature, because there's just such a deep knowing. And I think a deep knowing will always present a calmness. And maybe you could speak to this philosophically, or how all of this study has perhaps affected your life. Does it matter to you personally to live 50 or 100 years? Does that really matter? Or spiritually, where all of this has really affected you?
Yes, I would certainly agree with what you said, that walking into a forest and spending time there is in terms of my own personal experience, is something that really stands out. When I enter a forest, I feel differently. I can't explain why and how, but that's the inner feelings. But you can try to explain that rationally, but it's not easy. It's right. Quite difficult. But then you can go back to some very clever people like the famous philosopher Immanuel Kant, who lived, I don't know, 300 years ago. And he had this idea that basically there is knowledge that's independent of experience. And this is exactly what I feel when I get into a forest.
Beautiful, yes.
I can feel it.
Right.
I don't know how to explain it. And there is no need to explain it.
Exactly.
Really. So, because trying to explain it with our minds is incomplete.
Right.
Really limited.
Yeah, and it's so interesting hearing that and then looking at the latest research. For so long, everyone was dissecting brains. We're going to find the answer in there. And yet now we're finding more and more out, aren't we, about the heart and the brain. So they're not so separate in what they do for us in our body. It's more connected than that.
Absolutely. Again, a couple of people that I quoted in the book, Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, they called that embodied cognition. So embodied cognition means basically that heart can think, or
yes,
any part of our body can think in their own terms. I think that's something that is another kind of epistemological error of our modern civilization, separation of mind and body. I mean, that the idea is very old, from a philosopher called Descartes, who thought we humans are the only animals that have the brains and minds, so that led to the separation of mind and body. But today we know that that's not true. The mind and body cannot be separated. Maturana and Varela call this autopoiesis. This is a very important part of modern biology. Mainstream science still ignores that. But I think we can't really ignore it now, especially in the age of AI, because AI is really continuing this tradition of separation of mind and body. It's useful for many things that we do in our culture, but AI really cannot tell us anything that we didn't know before. It can only make our paths more narrow, ignoring trillions of possibilities that we have at our disposal.
Right, and that relates so much to pharmacology or medicine. Everything, including AI, it all has its place, but it can't be allowed to overtake our innate wisdom, maybe. We have to keep a hold on that.
Yeah, I agree. I hope that people will see that this wisdom we possess as living beings, you know, our wisdom is not greater or not deeper than the bacterial wisdom or the plant wisdom or modern culture. I wouldn't say modern science, but modern culture leads us into a path which projects humans as the superior species. You can accept that to a degree, but then at a deeper level, simply is not true. The human intelligence is one form of intelligence, but the intelligences of other species are not inferior to the human intelligence. So we can learn
from
other intelligences, and then through the process of learning, discover where we are wrong. Again, this guy, Gregory Bateson, called our arrogance, call that an epistemological error. When you read his books today, you really see how right he was. Mm-hmm. I mean, his main book was published in, I think, in 1970s. So it's called Mind and Nature.
Mm.
And then subtitle, A Necessary Unity. So for him, the mind was not the human mind, but
right.
the mind of nature. We are part of it.
So. Yeah. And part of this understanding, I really liked how you wrote about the suggestion for listening to bacterial conversation. I'm wondering, how do you do that? When I started thinking about it, I thought, oh, is bacterial communication, is it chemical? Is it chemistry?
Yeah, I think this is where proper science come into place, really. So listening to bacterial conversation, obviously that's a metaphor, but we can really examine how bacteria communicate, when I say we scientists.
Yes.
And a colleague of mine, James Shapiro, he's a professor at Chicago University, he was one of the first scientists who discovered how this communication between bacteria occurs through chemicals. So chemicals are in the bacterial language, and another scientist called that bacterial language. So chemicals in the bacterial language are like words and sentences in our language.
Right.
They communicate through that. But their language is richer in a sense that they also communicate through electrical impulses. They also communicate through exchanging genes. So really, when you enter into that level of investigation to see how bacteria communicate, you get amazed how that is complex and sophisticated and more complex than our language, because AI is just imitating our own language.
Right.
But then the language of bacteria is much more complex than our own language.
Yeah.
So, and then you immediately see that the approach taken by the human scientists and these large language models and AI is just a very tiny and narrow spectrum.
Right, yes. It doesn't take into consideration any of that which you're talking about with the bacteria. And I think we also communicate electrically and vibrationally, yes, but we're so unaware of it. We're not taking
Absolutely.
It into consideration. It's all happening, who you're attracted to and that sort of thing. It's definitely happening. You know, we're slow
Absolutely.
To go,
I mean,
but
this is part of that, what Kant, the philosopher, called knowledge independent of experience. We're simply not aware of that, but it's happening in our bodies. So for that reason, I think people who investigated human psyche, like Carl Gustav Jung, he had this term collective unconscious.
Yes.
So basically part of our inheritance, psychological inheritance, are animals, plants, bacteria.
Right.
So we now know that there are bacteria affecting the development of our brain when we are embryos, and this is called the psychobiome, etc.
Right.
So I think when you look at us, we are the products of bacteria and all other organisms that preceded us.
Yeah, and I don't ever think that there's ever one reason for anything, especially considering our scope of attention or scope of knowledge. I'm wondering if we as a species would start looking at time as circular rather than linear. I think that might help bring us out of that mechanistic viewpoint.
Yeah. You know, biologists, this guy I mentioned earlier, Umberto Maturana, he taught that what we call the evolution, this constant change of living structures and organisms, he taught that this is the product of a continuous present. For him, basically, there was no past, there is no future, but this biological substrate, this constantly changing living forms, this is the continuous present. And, you know, talking about the cycles, again, many biologists thought that the integral part of biology of any species is the existence in these cycles. I mean, we live in a cycle. We are born, then
right,
we get developed, and then we die. And that's closing the cycle. But that's perhaps not the end, because we continue in some part of us live somewhere else or something like that. And this is all the part of the great or greater cycles, like the cycle of the biosphere, etc.
Yeah. And Predrag, I have just one more question. Do you have a question in mind that you wish people would ask you about to further the investigation, taking us out of the mechanistic thinking and myopic kind of discovery?
Yes, would be to understand what it means to be stupid. I mean, from the human perspective, if I am a writer like the guy who produced Alice in Wonderland, everything there is opposite. And if Alice is to talk about bacteria, she would say bacteria are clever and we are stupid. Then basically the question for us is, what makes us stupid when we know that bacteria are clever? And I think this is something that Gregory Bateson called this the pathology of epistemology. So we think we are deeply intelligent. Our intelligence is much, much greater than the intelligence of plants or animals. But the question for us, why is our world so doomed? Is it because we are too intelligent, or maybe we are
too stupid?
So,
yeah, that's very good. And just hearing you say the word pathology, I thought we just have to make sure we know it's a very long path.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And when you look at the timeline of the modern civilization is relatively short, 300-400 years of development of modern science and technologies led us into a path that we now realizing, even though looks or sounds great
in some ways,
the question is, what will happen next?
Many thanks to Predrag Slijepcevic for sharing his book with us here today, Biocivilizations. For anything we do here, it's tributariesradio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.